In 1965, President Lyndon Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act. That legislation was aimed at helping African Americans exercise their right to vote. But that law didn't end voter suppression. Throughout the South, white segregationists continued to find ways to keep blacks from voting and participating freely in civic life. That same year, the federal government began the Head Start program as a way to improve education for children in poor families, part of President Johnson's war on poverty. In Mississippi, a group of civil rights activists decided to combine Head Start with voting rights. The collaboration came through an organization called the Child Development Group of Mississippi. The program not only gave black children access to early education, it also employed working-class black Mississippians and gave them the freedom to vote without fear of losing their jobs. A new book examines the origins of the Child Development Group of Mississippi. The book is called A Chance for Change, Head Start, and Mississippi's Black Freedom Struggle. And joining me now is Crystal Sanders, the author of the book and a professor of history and African American studies at Penn State University. She's going to be at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham on Tuesday, but on with me now on the state of things. Crystal Sanders, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
We should take one step back and talk about the war on poverty a little bit, because I think if people know anything about it, they know this is a way to sort of spend money, a way to just alleviate poverty through federal programs and federal spending. But it also empowered people locally at the grassroots to organize around how that money would be spent. And I think that's critical to understanding what you're talking about in this book. So if you can give us that context, it would be helpful.
Sure. Well, in 1964, in his State of the Union address, President Lyndon Johnson asked Congress for legislation that would allow the country to wage an unconditional war on poverty. That call became the Economic Opportunity Act of 1964. And the Economic Opportunity Act had several titles. It created a wide range of programs, including things like Job Corps, Work Study, and VISTA. Title II of the Economic Opportunity Act was the Community Action Program, and the authorizing legislation for the Community Action Program said that programs that were funded under Title II had to be operated with the maximum feasible participation of the poor. And what this meant is that working class individuals would have a role to play, significant, meaningful roles to play in the administration and operations of programs that were to serve them.
I'm going to take a half a step back here and remind our listeners here in North Carolina that that idea was patterned on what then Governor Terry Sanford created, which was called the North Carolina Fund, that did exactly that, the idea that you would empower local people to decide on how that money would be spent. Lyndon Johnson actually called Terry Sanford and said, "I understand you've got a program going on in North Carolina. Sounds like something I want to be interested in." So I just wanted to point that out. But this is key to understanding the basis and the essence of your book. Tell us then how the pushback and reaction to the Voting Rights Act and Head Start came together to create a real freedom movement in Mississippi.
Well, first, I should say that Head Start was not one of the original programs authorized by the Economic Opportunity Act in 1964. But the Office of Economic Opportunity creates Head Start in 1965 after learning that half of all poor people in the United States were under the age of five. So Head Start was created as a way of improving the educational opportunities for young kids as a way of hopefully preventing them from living lives in poverty. So in 1965, Head Start is funded under the Community Action Program, which meant, as a community action program, that Head Start had to be operated with the maximum feasible participation of the poor. When we go to a place like Mississippi, we know that even after 1965, life had not really changed for working class African Americans. So in 1964, President Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act. But what we see in Mississippi is that many business owners actually close their businesses rather than comply with desegregation of facilities. We know that after President Johnson signs the Voting Rights Act in 1965, we see that in Mississippi, it would be a year after that legislation is enacted before federal voter registrars enter the counties with the worst histories of black disfranchisement. It's in 1966, a year after the Voting Rights Act, that Vernon Damer, a black man in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, is killed by Klansmen because he's encouraging African Americans to register to vote. So what this tells us is that working-class black Mississippians were looking for ways to give the civil rights legislation of 1964 and 1965 real meaning in their lives. And they decided that Head Start might just be the avenue that they should pursue for full freedom. And the reason they were so attracted to Head Start was because, again, this was a community action program that said it had to be operated with the maximum feasible participation of the poor.
So, we should point out that direct intimidation is one of the suppression efforts, but other efforts included the threat of being fired from your job if you voted, right? I mean, this becomes
exactly.
a serious threat.
Exactly. And so because of this maximum feasible participation clause, what that meant was that local people had the opportunity to secure Head Start employment. This would mean that, first of all, they would be making more money than they had made previously, where most working class blacks in the state had been working as domestics or as cotton shoppers. It also meant that now they were not going to be employed by local people in the community, by local whites in the community. So this meant they had the financial freedom to be more politically active. It means they have the financial freedom to vote without the fear of economic reprisal. They have the financial freedom to send their kids to previously all white schools and not have to be concerned about losing their jobs. So Head Start gives them another avenue to pursue the very things they have been trying to pursue for decades.
And there was opposition to Head Start itself, and that was pretty violent in some cases. Tell us about the opposition to Head Start.
Exactly. Well, to understand the opposition to Head Start in Mississippi, we have to understand the long history of black education in that state. And dating back to the Reconstruction era, white supremacists had attempted to control, limit, and filter what black kids learned. But CDGM's program was untraditional in that Head Start teachers taught their students black history. They taught their students West African history. They taught their students to speak up, to ask questions, to assert themselves. And there were many white supremacists who found this type of curriculum to be quite dangerous. So what we see is that when these CDGM Head Start centers begin their operations in 1965, Klansmen burn certain centers to the ground. Night Riders shoot into centers regularly. We see teachers of these centers harassed by policemen on trumped-up traffic violations. All of these types of violent reprisals and economic reprisals were supposed to weaken CDGM's program. Now, despite all of this opposition, I argue in the book that the most potent opposition came from Senator John C. Stennis. And John Stennis was the junior senator from the state of Mississippi. He served alongside James Eastland, but Stennis served on both the Senate Appropriations Committee and the Senate Armed Services Committee. If you know anything about the way our Senate works, that means he was in a very powerful position because sitting on the Senate Appropriations Committee, he had control over the budgets for the war on Vietnam and the war on poverty. And he's able to use his political clout to discredit CDGM's program time and time again.
And come up with an alternative. I should point out CDGM, of course, is the Child Development Group of Mississippi that's essentially embodied to administer the Head Start program. So talk about his response to that and developing an alternative program.
Yes. Yeah, so Senator Stennis initially questioned the financial records of CDGM. So essentially he would make the argument that there was economic malfeasance, or that these people were in some way using money for illegal purposes. But when he calls for all of these audits, every single audit typically cleared these Head Start employees. It showed that for the most part, they were managing every single dime to the T. And these were multi-million dollar grants that working class black Mississippians were winning and were allocating and were using to educate their kids. So once the charges of economic malfeasance don't stick, he begins to question the qualifications of the teachers themselves, because in Head Start's initial years, teachers were not required to have formal credentials. So he begins to say, you know, the women who are working in these classrooms don't have the qualifications necessary to offer these kids quality early childhood education. Now, I found that to be very interesting that Stennis becomes concerned about the quality of education offered in these Head Start centers when he had never before expressed any concern about black education in the state of Mississippi. So this is a newfound interest that he has. We also see that he is not just making these allegations in Senate speeches, but he is in close contact with Sergeant Shriver, who's the director of the War on Poverty, director of the Office of Economic Opportunity. And he's telling Sergeant Shriver, I want this program defunded. I want to see a new program that's run by responsible people, that's run by Mississippians. And that's his way of that's coded language to suggest that things aren't being done the way they're supposed to be done in the state. And that's true. Mississippi had never really before given working class blacks the opportunity to control anything other than their churches.
Well,
and this was something new for Stennis.
Fascinating that he would say Mississippians, there is no more grassroots program. It can't be any more grassroots in Mississippi. But of course, for him, black people aren't Mississippians. What he means in coded language, and I guess what they mean today when they say real Americans, is white people.
Exactly. And remember, this argument about outsiders, right, or outside agitators had a long history when it came to civil rights in the South.
But I want to
point out,
there
was always this belief that local African Americans had to be content with their situation. So whoever was trying to change things or to challenge the racial status quo had to be an outsider.
But the money's coming from the outside, but the people running it are definitely from local communities.
Exactly. Indeed, these are black Mississippians who are his constituents. So he should get to know them. He should have gotten to know them, and he should have known that they indeed were Mississippians, just as the people that he wants to operate Head Start in the state were also Mississippians, but they were white Mississippians. They were middle class Mississippians.
Interestingly enough, it was defunded, CDGM, in 1968. And again, this was, I think, the political wrangling with Sergeant Shriver, who was, as you say, the head of the program at the time, and who had to worry about where his funding was going to come from if Stennis was opposed to him.
Exactly.
So what does this say? I mean, I think there's a larger narrative that perhaps people misunderstand about why the war on poverty ended. Some people say it failed. But I think this whole question of empowerment and grassroots power was one of the elements that gets lost in the picture. And I wonder how you see the war on poverty and its legacy and what this story says about that legacy.
Well, unfortunately, the dominant narrative that surrounds the war on poverty is one of failure. It was this idea that the United States attempted to wage a war on poverty and poverty won. Remember, that's what President Ronald Reagan says in his own State of the Union address in the 1980s. We also see these arguments that the war on poverty created big government, or it created a culture of dependency among working class Americans. But really, I hope that those who read my book will begin to think differently about the war on poverty, especially in Southern communities that had histories of abject poverty and histories of very poor race relations. Because what we see is that CDGM ends not because of funding. It ends not because the workers did not have the qualifications to administer a federal program, but it ends because it was too successful at challenging the status quo. It was too successful at giving working class black Mississippians a seat at decision-making tables. And it's because it was so successful and changing the way things were typically done that the white power structure worked consistently to kill this program. And so, indeed, we have to rethink these narratives that surround war on poverty programs. We have to rethink the idea that they did not work or that they could not work. Because when we look at a program on the ground like CDGM, we see that it allowed working class black Mississippians like Roxy Meredith, the mother of James Meredith, or Pap Hamer, the husband of Fannie Lou Hamer, to secure well-paying jobs outside of the white power structure, well-paying jobs that allowed them to continue the civil rights activity that they had been doing for years, but activity that had been in some ways curtailed because of economic intimidation and economic reprisals.
Crystal Sanders, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Crystal Sanders' new book is called A Chance for Change, Head Start, and Mississippi's Black Freedom Struggle. She reads at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham next Tuesday at 7 o'clock. And, of course, all the details are at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we're going to talk about a new book about Florida and how that state was made in the Roaring Twenties. Stay with us.